Welcome back to Analyzing Trends. Today we're confronting a subject as old as civilization itself, scapegoating. Why is it that when society encounters moments of disruption or ambiguity, we instinctively look for someone or something to blame? It's a reflex embedded deep in our collective behavior. Like the ticking of a clock, blame arrives right on time. Let's begin with the origins of the term itself. The word scapegoat traces back to an ancient ritual described in Leviticus 16. In this ceremony, a goat was symbolically burdened with the transgressions of the entire community, then cast out into the wilderness. The act wasn't just about the animal, it was about the people. A collective release, a way to project guilt outward, to restore a sense of order in the face of disorder. Fast forward to the 14th century. Europe is devastated by the Black Death. Amid the panic and mass mortality, Jewish communities become scapegoats, accused of causing the plague without any evidence. It wasn't truth that mattered, but fear, amplified by a society grasping for control. Centuries later, during the Red Scare in the United States, the term communist evolved into a blanket label, projected onto anyone who challenged the status quo. It became a vessel for anxieties about change, modernity, and perceived threats to national identity. And now, in 2025, scapegoating is everywhere, embedded in politics, echoed through media, and even surfacing in cultural arenas like fashion. It reflects a deeper discomfort, a growing intolerance for ambiguity. Our institutions, whether political, linguistic, or predictive, are increasingly ill-equipped to navigate complexity. Instead of adapting, they default to blame. That's the central argument we're exploring today. Scapegoating isn't merely a psychological reflex, it's a systemic signal, an indicator that the frameworks we rely on to make sense of the world are faltering under the weight of uncertainty. Let's turn to technology. In 2025, artificial intelligence has emerged as one of the most visible scapegoats in the cultural imagination. It's framed as the villain in headlines and everyday conversations alike. AI overlords, job-killing machines, algorithmic oppression. The language is evocative, almost mythic, but beneath it lies something deeper. Fear. Fear of displacement, of losing control, of accelerating change with no clear narrative. AI becomes the perfect symbol, abstract enough to absorb our collective anxieties, yet tangible enough to blame when systems fail or uncertainty rises. There's a dominant public narrative right now. AI is taking jobs, distorting truth, and undermining education. It's a story that circulates with urgency, but as we discussed in our earlier episode on AI purity and stigma, the reality is far more nuanced. A Pew Research study from last year revealed that a majority of Americans believe AI will deepen social and economic inequality. But that raises a crucial question. Is the threat inherent to the technology itself, or does it lie in how we choose to design, deploy, and regulate it? Scapegoating AI often masks a deeper discomfort, our failure to confront the human and institutional decisions shaping its impact. It's a pattern with precedent. Think of the Luddites not as anti-technology radicals, but as critics of exclusion and economic displacement. Their resistance wasn't to machines themselves, but to the systems that shut them out. In the same way, AI today becomes more than just a tool. It becomes a symbol. We're not angry at the algorithm per se. We're reacting to what it represents, a loss of agency, a sense of being outpaced by forces we don't fully understand. AI becomes a vessel, absorbing our collective fears about obsolescence, inequality, and the erosion of control. It's not the code that unnerves us. It's the cultural meaning we attach to it. But scapegoating isn't confined to technology. It's deeply woven into the way we talk about borders and about bodies. Immigration debates, in particular, are saturated with language charged by fear, invasion, replacement, cultural erosion. These aren't just policy concerns. they're narratives designed to assign blame. It's a familiar pattern. Outsiders are positioned as threats, not for what they do, but for what they symbolize: change, disruption, otherness. They become the stand-ins for economic anxiety, neighborhood transformation, even the loss of national identity. In many cases, they are scapegoated simply for existing. Then there's the generational blame game, an increasingly visible form of scapegoating. Gen Z, in particular, finds itself under constant scrutiny. Older generations label them entitled or fragile, often without acknowledging the economic and social conditions they've inherited. But the fractures aren't just generational. They run through the generation itself. On one side, there's what we've termed rich reset culture. Young people exploring identity, pausing careers, experimenting with new ways of living. On the other, a growing cohort locked out by debt, job precarity, and structural instability. The resentment flows in all directions. Labels like curated resilience, fake self-care, and chronically online act as shorthand. Not just for behavior, but for moral judgment. Even gender becomes a terrain of scapegoating. Incel subcultures, for example, have turned women into symbols of exclusion and unattainable belonging, blaming them for everything from loneliness to societal collapse. But it doesn't stop there. Young men, too, are increasingly cast as scapegoats, framed as emotionally stunted, politically dangerous, or existentially adrift. What gets lost in both cases is the underlying instability, the eroding social contracts, the economic abandonment, the absence of meaningful rites of passage. Scapegoating becomes a way to map confusion onto identity. It transforms systemic breakdown into interpersonal blame. It's not just discontent, it's disorientation given a target. At its core, what we're witnessing is a breakdown of trust across generations, across communities, and increasingly within the self. The promises that once underpinned social cohesion, mobility, meritocracy, solidarity, now feel increasingly fragile, even hollow. Scapegoating thrives in this atmosphere. It offers simplicity where there is complexity, certainty where there is doubt. But beneath every act of blame lies a deeper signal, a longing for systems we can believe in and a future that feels like it belongs to all of us. Now let's take a closer look at institutions. When systems falter, whether it's public health, academia, or government, the public narrative tends to collapse into something overly simple. Complexity is uncomfortable, so we reach for clarity, even if it's false. Immigrants are cast as invaders, a metaphor that militarizes movement and frames demographic change as existential threat. Universities are reduced to woke indoctrination factories, suggesting that the pursuit of knowledge has become dangerous or deceptive. Vaccines are framed as medical tyranny, collapsing centuries of scientific progress into a storyline of state control. These labels are emotionally resonant. They offer catharsis, a sense of certainty, even moral clarity. But analytically, they're shortcuts. They flatten layered realities into binaries: good versus evil, control versus freedom, tradition versus change. And in doing so, they sidestep the deeper work of grappling with institutional failure. Public health doesn't just fail in moments of crisis. It fails in how it communicates uncertainty. Academia doesn't just provoke backlash because of what it teaches, but because of who feels included or excluded from its rituals of legitimacy. Government mistrust isn't just about policy. It's about the perception that decision-making is happening in sealed rooms beyond the reach of democratic feedback. Scapegoating institutional actors provides a release valve. But it also distracts us from asking harder questions. Why have so many people lost faith in these systems? What would it take to rebuild that trust in a fragmented post-truth environment? Blame simplifies, but interpretation, real, patient, culturally literate interpretation is what complexity demands. Even in research and foresight, we're not immune. In fact, we often contribute to the problem by reaching for language that sounds rigorous but ultimately evades the core issue. Terms like disruption, resistance to change, or innovation fatigue are used as catch-alls, abstractions that allow us to talk around the real dynamics of power, access, and historical baggage. It becomes a kind of analytical outsourcing, substituting emotionally neutral jargon for the uncomfortable work of tracing who benefits, who's excluded, and whose worldview is being centered. When we call a backlash resistance to change, we risk obscuring whether that resistance is rooted in fear, legitimate grievance, or structural marginalization. The truth is, it's not working. Flattening complexity into buzzwords may help produce neat slide decks or tidy forecasts, but it distorts the landscape we're meant to interpret. It blinds us to contradiction, to ambivalence, to the ways people hold competing truths. And in doing so, it undermines foresight's greatest asset, its ability to hold the future open, not rush to closure. This might seem like a tangent, but it circles back to a concept we've written about and discussed at length, what we've called a living foresight model. At its core is the recognition that rational tools alone can't fully decode the irrational symbolic forces that drive cultural behavior. Culture doesn't move in linear patterns or neat timelines. It pulses with emotion, contradiction, and myth. Scapegoats aren't just social artifacts. They become part of our emotional infrastructure. They serve as pressure valves when collective anxiety builds faster than our institutions can interpret it. In moments of uncertainty, we turn to scapegoating not simply to assign blame, but to restore a temporary sense of order, even if it's illusory. In that sense, scapegoating is less about the target than the function. It tells us where meaning is breaking down, where our institutional maps no longer match the terrain, and where new interpretive frameworks are urgently needed. It's a cultural coping mechanism, yes, but it's also a signal, a call for better questions, not quicker answers. So, what do we do instead? We need better tools for sense-making. Tools that don't just describe change, but interpret it. Methods like cultural semiotics, psychosocial theory, and narrative analysis aren't optional add-ons. They're foundational. They help decode the unseen architectures of meaning that shape public emotion and guide institutional behavior. In today's climate, they're not just academic frameworks. Their survival tools. If we want to understand why blame recurs, why scapegoating feels so instinctive, we have to examine the symbolic undercurrents, the myths we inherit, the metaphors we reach for, the stories we tell about risk, identity, and control. Without those lenses, we're left reacting to the surface. With them, we begin to trace deeper patterns. Patterns that point not just to what's happening, but to why it matters, and what it conceals. That means moving beyond data aggregation and trend indexing. We need to ask, what collective anxieties are being displaced onto public figures or technologies? What foundational narratives are being rewritten under the surface of policy debates or cultural backlash? What social facts do these signals reveal, and how are they connected to a broader system of meaning? And yes, it's messy. But as we discussed in our work on Bayesian frameworks in measuring the irrationality of culture, the most meaningful insight often lives in the margins, in the outliers, the contradictions, the anomalies that refuse to fit cleanly into dominant narratives. That's where sense-making becomes real, when we resist the urge to resolve tension too quickly and instead learn to sit with dissonance. We need research practices that can evolve, methods capable of holding complexity without folding under the pressure to produce tidy, consumable conclusions. This doesn't mean abandoning rigor, it means expanding what we consider rigorous, approaches that make space for uncertainty, that map emotional turbulence, that engage with narrative friction rather than smoothing it over, because the world isn't neat. Cultural behavior doesn't follow clean lines or logical progressions, and if we want to understand it with any integrity, our tools have to mirror that unevenness, not just describe patterns, but also trace the rupture points, the contradictions, the unresolved symbolic tensions that often carry the most meaning. Here's the thing, scapegoating isn't just a social problem, it's a story system. It emerges where collective pain outpaces our ability to articulate it. It marks the places where institutions fail to metabolize uncertainty, where emotional overload fills the void left by structural breakdown. In that sense, scapegoats function less as explanations and more as placeholders, narrative shortcuts that reveal a deeper struggle with meaning itself. Right now, we're living through a kind of cultural revolution, one that lacks a singular name or ideological banner, but is no less transformative. The semiotic system, the network of meanings we use to interpret the world, is in active flux. Words are being redefined, symbols are being recoded, norms that once offered stability are now contested terrain. The result is a kind of semiotic volatility. What once felt like shared understanding is now fragmented, a landscape of competing truths and narrative dissonance. Scapegoating thrives in that environment, not because it resolves the ambiguity, but because it gives it form. It simplifies the unspeakable, and in doing so, it shows us exactly where meaning has gone unstable. If we want to build better futures, we need to become myth-aware, fluent in the cultural, emotional, and symbolic languages through which people make meaning. Foresight cannot remain confined to projection and probability. It must evolve into a practice of interpretation, one that engages with the symbolic density of the present, not just the metrics of the future. That means doing more than identifying trends. It means engaging in ritual repair, the restoration of coherence where institutional trust has eroded, where cultural meaning has unraveled. It requires attending to the emotional aftershocks of disruption and the symbolic scaffolding people use to orient themselves in uncertain times. And this is where re-enchantment becomes not an indulgence but a necessity. In a world dominated by abstraction, re-enchantment is the act of rerouting our models of the future in meaning, in narrative, in ritual, in wonder. It invites us to construct futures that people can feel, not just analyze, not as a return to fantasy, but as a forward-facing recognition that people need stories that speak to their hopes, their losses, and their longing for significance. Because the future doesn't need clearer enemies, it needs better stories, stories that restore symbolic possibility, that honor complexity without collapsing into fear, that reframe disruption as a threshold, not an end point. Stories that help us metabolize uncertainty and imagine worlds worth moving toward. So, as we wrap up, here's something to consider. The next time you notice a scapegoat, a person, a technology, a trend, ask what deeper issue it might be standing in for. What tension is going unnamed? What complexity is being displaced? In cultural research and foresight, scapegoats can help us see what our systems are struggling to process. They point to gaps in meaning, moments where uncertainty overwhelms sense-making. Rather than taking them at face value, we should treat scapegoats as signals, indicators of where new understanding is needed. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Analyzing Trends.